The stove had commenced to glow, but there was no heat coming from it. I began to fear that I might doze off and miss the dinner. That would mean lying awake on an empty belly all night. I got panic-stricken. Just a moment before the gong went off, I jumped out of bed, and, locking the door behind me, I bolted downstairs to the courtyard. There I got lost, one quadrangle after another, one staircase after another. I wandered in and out of buildings, searching frantically for the refectory. Past a long line of youngsters marching in a column to God knows where, they moved along like a chain gang, with a slave driver at the head of the column. Finally, I saw an energetic-looking individual with a derby heading toward me. I stopped him to ask the way to the refectory. Happened, I stopped the right man. It was Monsieur le Proviseur, and he seemed delighted to have stumbled on me. Wanted to know right away if I was comfortably settled, if there was anything more he could do for me. I told him everything was okay, only it was a bit chilly, I ventured to add. He assured me that it was rather unusual, this weather. Now and then, the fogs came on, and a bit of snow, and then it became unpleasant for a while, and so on and so forth. All the while, he had me by the arm, guiding me toward the refectory. He seemed like a very decent chap, a regular guy, I thought to myself. I even went so far as to imagine that I might get chummy with him later on, that he'd invite me to his room on a bitter cold night and make a hot grog for me. I imagined all sorts of friendly things in the few moments it required to reach the door of the refectory. Here, my mind racing on at a mile a minute, he suddenly shook hands with me and, doffing his hat, bade me good night. I was so bewildered that I tipped my hat also. It was the regular thing to do, I soon found out. Whenever you pass a prof, or even Monsieur l'Econome, you doff the hat. Might pass the same guy a dozen times a day. Makes no difference. You've got to give the salute, even though your hat is worn out. It's the polite thing to do. Anyway, I had found the refectory. Like an East Side clinic it was, with tiled walls, bare light, and marble-top tables. And, of course, a big stove with an elbow pipe. The dinner wasn't served yet. A cripple was running in and out with dishes and knives and forks and bottles of wine. In a corner, several young men conversing animatedly. I went up to them and introduced myself. They gave me a most cordial reception. Almost too cordial, in fact. I couldn't quite make it out. In a jiffy, the room began to fill up. I was presented from one to the other quickly. Then they formed a circle about me, and, filling the glasses, they began to sing. L'autre soir l'idée m'est venue, crénom de Zeus d'enculé en pendu. Le vent se lève sur la potence, voilà mon pendu qui se balance. J'ai dû l'enculer en sautant, crénom de Zeus, on n'est jamais content. Baiser dans un con trop petit, crénom de Zeus, on s'écorche le vie. Baiser dans un con trop large, on ne sait pas où l'on décharge. Se branler étant bien émerdant, crénom de Zeus, on n'est jamais content. With this, Quasimodo announced the dinner. They were a cheerful group, les surveillants. There was Croa, who belched like a pig and always let off a loud fart when he sat down to the table. He could fart 13 times in succession, they informed me. He held the record. Then there was Monsieur Le Prince, an athlete who was fond of wearing a tuxedo in the evening when he went to town. He had a beautiful complexion, just like a girl, and never touched the wine nor read anything that might tax his brain. Next to him sat Petit Paul, from the Midi, who thought of nothing but cunt all the time. He used to say every day, "À partir de jeudi, je ne parlerai plus de femmes." He and Monsieur Le Prince were inseparable. Then there was Passelot, a veritable young scallywag who was studying medicine and who borrowed right and left. He talked incessantly of Ronsard, Villon, and Rabelais. Opposite me sat Molès, agitator and organizer of the peon, who insisted on weighing the meat to see if it wasn't short a few grams. He occupied a little room in the infirmary. His supreme enemy was Monsieur L'Econome, which was nothing particularly to his credit, since everybody hated this individual. For companion, Molesse had one called Le Pénible, a dour-looking chap with a hawk-like profile who practiced the strictest economy and acted as a moneylender. He was like an engraving by Albrecht Dürer, a composite of all the dour, sour, morose, bitter, unfortunate, unlucky, and introspective devils who composed the pantheon of Germany's medieval knights. A Jew, no doubt. At any rate, he was killed in an automobile accident shortly after my arrival, a circumstance which left me 23 francs to the good. With the exception of Renault, who sat beside me, the others have faded out of my memory. They belong to that category of colorless individuals who make up the world of engineers, architects, dentists, pharmacists, teachers, etc. There was nothing to distinguish them from the clods whom they would later wipe their boots on. They were zeros in every sense of the word, ciphers who form the nucleus of a respectable and lamentable citizenry. They ate with their heads down, and were always the first to clamor for a second helping. They slept soundly and never complained. They were neither gay nor miserable, the indifferent ones whom Dante consigned to the vestibule of hell, the upper crusters. It was the custom after dinner to go immediately to town, unless one was on duty in the dormitories. In the center of town were the cafes, huge, dreary halls where the somnolent merchants of Dijon gathered to play cards and listen to the music. It was warm in the cafes, that is the best I can say of them. The seats were fairly comfortable, too. And there were always a few whores about who, for a glass of beer or a cup of coffee, would sit and chew the fat with you. The music, on the other hand, was atrocious. Such music! On a winter's night, in a dirty hole like Dijon, nothing can be more harassing, more nerve-wracking, than the sound of a French orchestra, particularly one of those lugubrious female orchestras, with everything coming in squeaks and farts, with a dry algebraic rhythm and the hygienic consistency of toothpaste. A wheezing and scraping performed at so many francs the hour, and the devil take the hindmost. The melancholy of it, as if old Euclid had stood up on his hind legs and swallowed prussic acid. The whole realm of idea, so thoroughly exploited by the reason that there is nothing left of which to make music except the empty slats of the accordion, through which the wind whistles and tears the ether to tatters. However, to speak of music in connection with this outpost is like dreaming of champagne when you are in the death cell. Music was the least of my worries. I didn't even think of Kant. So dismal, so chill, so barren, so gray was it all. On the way home the first night, I noticed on the door of a café an inscription from the Gargantua. Inside the café, it was like a morgue. However, forward. I had plenty of time on my hands and not a sou to spend. 2 or 3 hours of conversational lessons a day, and that was all. And what use was it, teaching these poor bastards English? I felt sorry as hell for them, all morning plugging away on John Gilpin's Ride, and in the afternoon coming to me to practice a dead language. I thought of the good time I had wasted reading Virgil, or wading through such incomprehensible nonsense as Hermann und Dorothea. The insanity of it. Learning, the empty breadbasket. I thought of Carl, who can recite Faust backwards, who never writes a book without praising the shit out of his immortal, incorruptible Goethe. And yet he hadn't the sense enough to take on a rich cunt and get himself a change of underwear. There's something obscene in this love of the past which ends in breadlines and dugouts. Something obscene about this spiritual racket which permits an idiot to sprinkle holy water over big berthas and dreadnoughts and high explosives. Every man with a bellyful of the classics is an enemy to the human race. Here was I, supposedly to spread the gospel of Franco-American amity, the emissary of a corpse who, after he had plundered right and left, after he had caused untold suffering and misery, dreamed of establishing universal peace. Pooey! What did they expect me to talk about, I wonder? About leaves of grass? About the tariff walls? About the Declaration of Independence? About the latest gang war? What? Just what, I'd like to know. Well, I'll tell you, I never mentioned these things. I started right off the bat with a lesson in the physiology of love. How the elephants make love. That was it. It caught like wildfire. After the first day, there were no more empty benches. After that first lesson in English, they were standing at the door waiting for me. We got along swell together. They asked all sorts of questions, as though they had never learned a damn thing. I let them fire away. I taught them to ask still more ticklish questions. Ask anything. That was my motto. I'm here as the plenipotentiary from the realm of free spirits. I'm here to create a fever and a ferment. In some ways, says an eminent astronomer, the material universe appears to be passing away like a tale that is told, dissolving into nothingness like a vision. That seems to be the general feeling underlying the empty breadbasket of learning. Myself, I don't believe it. I don't believe a fucking thing these bastards try to shove down our throats. Between sessions, if I had no book to read, I would go upstairs to the dormitory and chat with the peon. They were delightfully ignorant of all that was going on, especially in the world of art. Almost as ignorant as the students themselves. It was as if I had gotten into a private little madhouse with no exit signs. Sometimes I snooped around under the arcades, watching the kids marching along with huge hunks of bread stuck in their dirty mugs. I was always hungry myself, since it was impossible for me to go to breakfast, which was handed out at some ungodly hour of the morning, just when the bed was getting toasty. Huge bowls of blue coffee, with chunks of white bread and no butter to go with it. For lunch, beans or lentils, with bits of meat thrown in to make it look appetizing. Food fit for a chain gang, for rock breakers. Even the wine was lousy. Things were either diluted or bloated. There were calories, but no cuisine. Monsieur L'Econome was responsible for it all, so they said. I don't believe that either. He was paid to keep our heads just above the waterline. He didn't ask if we were suffering from piles or carbuncles. He didn't inquire if we had delicate palates or the intestines of wolves. Why should he? He was hired at so many grams the plate to produce so many kilowatts of energy. Everything in terms of horsepower. It was all carefully reckoned in the fat ledgers which the pasty-faced clerks scribbled in morning, noon, and night, debit and credit, with a red line down the middle of the page. Roaming around the quadrangle with an empty belly most of the time, I got to feel slightly mad, like Charles the Silly, poor devil, only I had no Odette Chandivert with whom to play Stinkfinger. Half the time I had to grub cigarettes from the students, and during the lessons sometimes I munched a bit of dry bread with them. As the fire was always going out on me, I soon used up my allotment of wood. It was the devil's own time coaxing a little wood out of the ledger clerks. Finally, I got so riled up about it that I would go out in the street and hunt for firewood like an Arab. Astonishing how little firewood you could pick up in the streets of Dijon. However, these little foraging expeditions brought me into strange precincts. Got to know the little street named after a Monsieur Philibert Papillon, a dead musician, I believe, where there was a cluster of whorehouses. It was always more cheerful hereabouts. There was the smell of cooking and wash hanging out to dry. Once in a while, I caught a glimpse of the poor half-wits who lounged about inside. They were better off than the poor devils in the center of town, whom I used to bump into whenever I walked through a department store. I did that frequently in order to get warm. They were doing it for the same reason, I suppose, looking for someone to buy them a coffee. They looked a little crazy with the cold and the loneliness. The whole town looked a bit crazy when the blue of evening settled over it. You could walk up and down the main drive any Thursday in the week till doomsday and never meet an expansive soul. 60 or 70,000 people, perhaps more, wrapped in woolen underwear, and nowhere to go and nothing to do. Turning out mustard by the carload. Female orchestras grinding out the Merry Widow. Silver service in the big hotels. The ducal palace rotting away stone by stone, limb by limb. The trees screeching with frost. A ceaseless clatter of wooden shoes. The university celebrating the death of Goethe. Or the birth, I don't remember which. It's usually the deaths that are celebrated. Idiotic affair anyway. Everybody yawning and stretching. Coming through the high driveway into the quadrangle, a sense of abysmal futility always came over me. Outside, bleak and empty. Inside, bleak and empty. A scummy sterility hanging over the town. A fog of book learning. Slag and cinders of the past. Around the interior courts were ranged the classrooms, little shacks, such as you might see in the North Woods, where the pedagogues gave free rein to their voices. On the blackboard, the futile abracadabra which the future citizens of the Republic would have to spend their lives forgetting. Once in a while, the parents were received in the big reception room, just off the driveway, where there were busts of the heroes of antiquity, such as Molière, Racine, Corneille, Voltaire, etc. All the scarecrows whom the cabinet ministers mention with moist lips whenever an immortal is added to the waxworks. No bust of Villon, no bust of Rabelais, no bust of Rimbaud. Anyway, they met here in solemn conclave, the parents and the stuffed shirts whom the state hires to bend the minds of the young. Always this bending process, this landscape gardening to make the mind more attractive. And the youngsters came too occasionally. The little sunflowers, who would soon be transplanted from the nursery in order to decorate the municipal grass plots. Some of them were just rubber plants, easily dusted with a torn chemise. All of them jerking away for dear life in the dormitories as soon as the night came on. The dormitories. Where the red lights glowed, where the bell rang like a fire alarm, where the treads were hollowed out in the scramble to reach the education cells. Then there were the profs. During the first few days, I got so far as to shake hands with a few of them. And of course, there was always the salute with the hat when we passed under the arcades. But as for a heart-to-heart talk, as for walking to the corner and having a drink together, nothing doing. It was simply unimaginable. Most of them looked as though they had had the shit scared out of them. Anyway, I belonged to another hierarchy. They wouldn't even share a louse with the likes of me. They made me so damned irritated just to look at them that I used to curse them under my breath when I saw them coming. I used to stand there, leaning against a pillar, with a cigarette in the corner of my mouth and my hat down over my eyes. And when they got within hailing distance, I would let squirt a good gob and up with a hat. I didn't even bother to open my trap and bid them the time of day. Under my breath, I simply said, "Fuck you, Jack," and let it go at that. After a week, it seemed as if I had been here all my life. It was like a bloody fucking nightmare that you can't throw off. Used to fall into a coma thinking about it. Just a few days ago, I had arrived. Nightfall. People scurrying home like rats under the foggy lights. The trees glittering with diamond-pointed malice. I thought it all out 1,000 times or more. From the station to the Lycée, it was like a promenade through the Danzig corridor. All deckle-edged, crannied, nerve-ridden. A lane of dead bones, of crooked, cringing figures buried in shrouds. Spines made of sardine bones. The Lycée itself seemed to rise up out of a lake of thin snow, an inverted mountain that pointed down toward the center of the earth, where God or the devil works always in a straitjacket, grinding grist for that paradise which is always a wet dream. If the sun ever shone, I don't remember it. I remember nothing but the cold, greasy fogs that blew in from the frozen marshes over yonder, where the railroad tracks burrowed into the lurid hills. Down near the station was a canal, or perhaps it was a river, hidden away under a yellow sky, with little shacks pasted slap up against the rising edge of the banks. There was a barracks, too, somewhere, it struck me, because every now and then I met little yellow men from Cochin China, squirmy, opium-faced runts peeping out of their baggy uniforms, like dyed skeletons packed in excelsior. The whole goddamn medievalism of the place was infernally ticklish and restive, rocking back and forth with low moans, jumping out at you from the eaves, hanging like broken-necked criminals from the gargoyles. I kept looking back all the time, kept walking like a crab that you prong with a dirty fork. All those fat little monsters, those slab-like effigies pasted on the façade of the Église Saint-Michel. They were following me down the crooked lanes and around the corners. The whole façade of Saint-Michel seemed to open up like an album at night, leaving you face to face with the horrors of the printed page. When the lights went out and the characters faded away flat, dead as words, then it was quite magnificent, the façade. In every crevice of the old gnarled front, there was the hollow chant of the night wind, and over the lacy rubble of cold, stiff vestments, there was a cloudy, absinthe-like drool of fog and frost. Here, where the church stood, everything seemed turned hindside front. The church itself must have been twisted off its base by centuries of progress in the rain and snow. It lay in the Place Edgar Quinet, squat against the wind, like a dead mule. Through the Rue de la Monnaie, the wind rushed like white hair streaming wild. It whirled around the white hitching posts, which obstructed the free passage of omnibuses and 20 mule teams. Swinging through this exit in the early morning hours, I sometimes stumbled upon Monsieur Renaud, who, wrapped in his cowl like a gluttonous monk, made overtures to me in the language of the 16th century. Falling in step with Monsieur Renaud, the moon busting through the greasy sky like a punctured balloon, I fell immediately into the realm of the transcendental. Monsieur Renaud had a precise speech, dry as apricots, with a heavy Brandenburger bass. He used to come at me full tilt from Goethe or Fichte, with deep bass notes that rumbled in the windy corners of the place like claps of last year's thunder. Men of Yucatan, men of Zanzibar, men of Tierra del Fuego, save me from this glaucous hog rind. The north piles up about me, the glacial fjords, the blue-tipped spines, the crazy lights, the obscene Christian chant that spread like an avalanche from Etna to the Aegean. Everything frozen tight as scum, the mind locked and rimed with frost, and through the melancholy bales of Chitterwit, the choking gargle of louse-eaten saints. White I am, and wrapped in wool, swaddled, fettered, hamstrung, but in this I have no part. White to the bone, but with a cold alkali base, with saffron-tipped fingers. White, aye, but no brother of learning, no Catholic heart. White and ruthless as the men before me who sailed out of the Elbe. I look to the sea, to the sky, to what is unintelligible and distantly near. End of side 14. Side 15. The snow underfoot scurries before the wind, blows, tickles, stings, lisps away, whirls aloft, showers, splinters, sprays down. No sun, no roar of surf, no breaker's surge. The cold north wind pointed with barbed shafts, icy, malevolent, greedy, blighting, paralyzing. The streets turn away on their crooked elbows. They break from the hurried sight, the stern glance. They hobble away down the drifting latticework, wheeling the church hindside front, mowing down the statues, flattening the monuments, uprooting the trees, stiffening the grass, sucking the fragrance out of the earth. Leaves dull as cement, leaves no dew can bring to glisten again. No moon will ever silver their listless plight. The seasons are come to a stagnant stop. The trees blench and wither. The wagons roll in the mica ruts with slithering, harp-like thuds. In the hollow of the white-tipped hills, lurid and boneless Dijon slumbers. No man alive and walking through the night except the restless spirits moving southward toward the sapphire grids. Yet I am up and about, a walking ghost, a white man terrorized by the cold sanity of this slaughterhouse geometry. Who am I? What am I doing here? I fall between the cold walls of human malevolence, a white figure fluttering, sinking down through the cold lake, a mountain of skulls above me. I settle down to the cold latitudes, the chalk steps washed with indigo. The earth in its dark corridors knows my step, feels a foot abroad, a wing stirring, a gasp and a shudder. I hear the learning chaffed and chuzzled, the figures mounting upward, bat slime dripping aloft and clanging with pasteboard golden wings. I hear the trains collide, the chains rattle, the locomotive chugging, snorting, sniffing, steaming, and pissing. All things come to me through the clear fog with the odor of repetition, with yellow hangovers and gadzooks and wettikins. In the dead center, far below Dijon, far below the Hyperborean regions, stands God Ajax, his shoulders strapped to the mill wheel, the olives crunching, the green marsh water alive with croaking frogs. The fog and snow, the cold latitude, the heavy learning, the blue coffee, the unbuttered bread, the soup and lentils, the heavy pork packer beans, the stale cheese, the soggy chow, the lousy wine, have put the whole penitentiary into a state of constipation. And just when everyone has become shit-tight, the toilet pipes freeze. The shit piles up like anthills. One has to move down from the little pedestals and leave it on the floor. It lies there, stiff and frozen, waiting for the thaw. On Thursdays, the hunchback comes with his little wheelbarrow, shovels the cold, stiff turds with a broom and pan, and trundles off, dragging his withered leg. The corridors are littered with toilet paper. It sticks to your feet like flypaper. When the weather moderates, the odor gets ripe. You can smell it in Winchester, 40 miles away. Standing over that ripe dung in the morning with a toothbrush, the stench is so powerful that it makes your head spin. We stand around in red flannel shirts, waiting to spit down the hole. It is like an aria from one of Verdi's great operas, an anvil chorus with pulleys and syringes. In the night, when I am taken short, I rush down to the private toilet of Monsieur le Censeur, just off the driveway. My stool is always full of blood. His toilet doesn't flush either, but at least there is the pleasure of sitting down. I leave my little bundle for him as a token of esteem. Toward the end of the meal each evening, the veilleur de nuit drops in for his bit of cheer. This is the only human being in the whole institution with whom I feel a kinship. He is a nobody. He carries a lantern and a bunch of keys. He makes the rounds through the night, stiff as an automaton. About the time the stale cheese is being passed around, in he pops for his glass of wine. He stands there with paw outstretched, his hair stiff and wiry, like a mastiff's, his cheeks ruddy, his mustache gleaming with snow. He mumbles a word or two, and Quasimodo brings him the bottle. Then, with feet solidly planted, he throws back his head, and down it goes, slowly, in one long draft. To me, it's like he's pouring rubies down his gullet. Something about this gesture which seizes me by the hair. It's almost as if he were drinking down the dregs of human sympathy. As if all the love and compassion in the world could be tossed off like that, in one gulp. As if that were all that could be squeezed together day after day. A little less than a rabbit they have made him. In the scheme of things, he's not worth the brine to pickle a herring. He's just a piece of live manure, and he knows it. When he looks around after his drink and smiles at us, the world seems to be falling to pieces. It's a smile thrown across an abyss. The whole stinking civilized world lies like a quagmire at the bottom of the pit. And over it, like a mirage, hovers this wavering smile. It was the same smile which greeted me at night when I returned from my rambles. I remember one such night when, standing at the door waiting for the old fellow to finish his rounds, I had such a sense of well-being that I could have waited thus forever. I had to wait perhaps half an hour before he opened the door. I looked about me calmly and leisurely, drank everything in. The dead tree in front of the school with its twisted rope branches, the houses across the street, which had changed color during the night, which curved now more noticeably, the sound of a train rolling through the Siberian wastes, the railings painted by Utrillo, the sky, the deep wagon ruts. Suddenly, out of nowhere, two lovers appeared. Every few yards they stopped and embraced, and when I could no longer follow them with my eyes, I followed the sound of their steps, heard the abrupt stop, and then the slow, meandering gait. I could feel the sag and slump of their bodies when they leaned against a rail, heard their shoes creak as the muscles tightened for the embrace. Through the town they wandered, through the crooked streets, toward the glassy canal where the water lay black as coal. There was something phenomenal about it. In all Dijon, not two like them. Meanwhile, the old fellow was making the rounds. I could hear the jingle of his keys, the crunching of his boots, the steady, automatic tread. Finally, I heard him coming through the driveway to open the big door, a monstrous arched portal without a moat in front of it. I heard him fumbling at the lock, his hands stiff, his mind numbed. As the door swung open, I saw over his head a brilliant constellation crowning the chapel. Every door was locked, every cell bolted. The books were closed. The night hung close, dagger-pointed, drunk as a maniac. There it was, the infinitude of emptiness. Over the chapel, like a bishop's mitre, hung the constellation. Every night during the winter months, it hung there low over the chapel. Low and bright, a handful of dagger points, a dazzle of pure emptiness. The old fellow followed me to the turn of the drive. The door closed silently. As I bade him good night, I caught that desperate, hopeless smile again, like a meteoric flash over the rim of a lost world. And again I saw him standing in the refectory, his head thrown back and the rubies pouring down his gullet. The whole Mediterranean seemed to be buried inside him. The orange groves, the cypress trees, the winged statues, the wooden temples, the blue sea, the stiff masks, the mystic numbers, the mythological birds, the sapphire skies, the eaglets, the sunny coves, the blind bards, the bearded heroes. Gone all that, sunk beneath the avalanche from the north, buried dead forever, a memory, a wild hope. For just a moment, I linger at the carriageway. The shroud, the pall, the unspeakable, clutching emptiness of it all. Then I walk quickly along the gravel path near the wall, past the arches and columns, the iron staircases, from one quadrangle to the other. Everything is locked tight, locked for the winter. I find the arcade leading to the dormitory. A sickish light spills down over the stairs from the grimy, frosted windows. Everywhere the paint is peeling off. The stones are hollowed out. The banister creaks. A damp sweat oozes from the flagging and forms a pale, fuzzy aura pierced by the feeble red light at the head of the stairs. I mount the last flight, the turret, in a sweat and terror. In pitch darkness, I grope my way through the deserted corridor, every room empty, locked, molding away. My hand slides along the wall, seeking the keyhole. A panic comes over me as I grasp the doorknob, always a hand at my collar, ready to yank me back. Once inside the room, I bolt the door. It's a miracle which I perform each night, the miracle of getting inside without being strangled, without being struck down by an axe. I can hear the rats scurrying through the corridor, gnawing away over my head between the thick rafters. The light glares like burning sulfur, and there is the sweet, sickish stench of a room which is never ventilated. In the corner stands the coal box, just as I left it. The fire is out. A silence so intense that it sounds like Niagara Falls in my ears. Alone, with a tremendous, empty longing and dread. The whole room for my thoughts. Nothing but myself and what I think, what I fear. Could think the most fantastic thoughts. Could dance, spit, grimace, curse, wail. Nobody would ever know. Nobody would ever hear. The thought of such absolute privacy is enough to drive me mad. It's like a clean birth, everything cut away. Separate, naked, alone. Bliss and agony simultaneously. Time on your hands, each second weighing on you like a mountain. You drown in it. Deserts, seas, lakes, oceans. Time beating away like a meat axe. Nothingness. The world. The me and the not me. Uma harumuma. Everything has to have a name. Everything has to be learned, tested, experienced. Faites comme chez vous, chérie. The silence descends in volcanic shoots. Yonder in the barren hills, rolling onward toward the great metallurgical regions, the locomotives are pulling their merchant products. Over steel and iron beds they roll, the ground sown with slag and cinders and purple ore. In the baggage cars, kelps, fish plate, rolled iron, sleepers, wire rods, plates and sheets, laminated articles, hot rolled hoops, splints and mortar carriages, and Zorez ore. The wheels, U80 millimeters or over. Pass splendid specimens of Anglo-Norman architecture. Pass pedestrians and pederasts, open hearth furnaces, basic Bessemer mills, dynamos and transformers, pig iron castings and steel ingots. The public at large, pedestrians and pederasts, goldfish and spun glass palm trees, donkeys sobbing, all circulating freely through quincunxial alleys. At the Place du Brésil, a lavender eye. Going back in a flash over the women I've known, it's like a chain which I've forged out of my own misery, each one bound to the other. A fear of living separate, of staying born. The door of the womb always on the latch, dread and longing. Deep in the blood, the pull of paradise, the beyond, always the beyond. It must have all started with the navel. They cut the umbilical cord, give you a slap on the ass, and presto, You're out in the world, adrift, a ship without a rudder. You look at the stars, and then you look at your navel. You grow eyes everywhere, in the armpits, between the lips, in the roots of your hair, on the soles of your feet. What is distant becomes near. What is near becomes distant. Inner, outer, a constant flux, a shedding of skins, a turning inside out. You drift around like that for years and years until you find yourself in the dead center. And there you slowly rot, slowly crumble to pieces, get dispersed again. Only your name remains. It was spring before I managed to escape from the penitentiary, and then only by a stroke of fortune. A telegram from Carl informed me one day that there was a vacancy upstairs. He said he would send me the fare back if I decided to accept. I telegraphed back at once, and as soon as the dough arrived, I beat it to the station. Not a word to Monsieur le Proviseur or anyone. French leave, as they say. I went immediately to the hotel at numero 1B, where Carl was staying. He came to the door, stark naked. It was his night off, and there was a cunt in the bed as usual. "Don't mind her," he says. "She's asleep. If you need a lay, you can take her on. She's not bad." He pulls the covers back to show me what she looks like. However, I wasn't thinking about a lay right away. I was too excited. I was like a man who had just escaped from jail. I just wanted to see and hear things. Coming from the station, it was like a long dream. I felt as though I had been away for years. It was not until I had sat down and taken a good look at the room that I realized I was back again in Paris. It was Carl's room, and no mistake about it, like a squirrel cage and shithouse combined. There was hardly room on the table for the portable machine he used. It was always like that, whether he had a cunt with him or not. Always a dictionary lying open on a gilt-edged volume of Faust. Always a tobacco pouch, a beret, a bottle of vin rouge, letters, manuscripts, old newspapers, watercolors, teapot, dirty socks, toothpicks, Crucian salts, condoms, etc. In the bidet were orange peels and the remnants of a ham sandwich. "There's some food in the closet," he said. "Help yourself. I was just going to give myself an injection." I found the sandwich he was talking about and a piece of cheese that he had nibbled at beside it. While he sat on the edge of the bed, dosing himself with Argyrol, I put away the sandwich and cheese with the aid of a little wine. "I like that letter you sent me about Goethe," he said, wiping his prick with a dirty pair of drawers. "I'll show you the answer to it in a minute. I'm putting it in my book. The trouble with you is that you're not a German. Now you have to be German to understand Goethe. Shit, I'm not going to explain it to you now. I put it all in the book. By the way, I've got a new cunt now. Not this one. This one's a half-wit. At least, I had her until a few days ago. I'm not sure whether she'll come back or not. She was living with me all the time you were away. The other day, her parents came and took her away. They said she was only 15. Can you beat that? They scared the shit out of me, too." I began to laugh. It was like Carl to get himself into a mess like that. "What are you laughing for?" he said. "I may go to prison for it. Luckily, I didn't knock her up. And that's funny, too, because she never took care of herself properly. But do you know what saved me? So I think, at least. It was Faust. Yeah. Her old man happened to see it lying on the table. He asked me if I understood German. One thing led to another, and before I knew it, he was looking through my books. Fortunately, I happened to have the Shakespeare open, too. That impressed him like hell. He said I was evidently a very serious guy." "What about the girl? What did she have to say?" "She was frightened to death. You see, she had a little watch with her when she came. In the excitement, we couldn't find the watch, and her mother insisted that the watch be found or she'd call the police. You see how things are here. I turned the whole place upside down, but I couldn't find the goddamn watch. The mother was furious. I liked her, too, in spite of everything. She was even better looking than the daughter. Here, I'll show you a letter I started to write to her. I'm in love with her." "With the mother?" "Sure, why not? If I'd seen the mother first, I'd never have looked at the daughter. How did I know she was only 15? You don't ask a cunt how old she is before you lay her, do you?" "Joe, There's something funny about this. You're not shitting me, are you? Am I shitting you? Here, look at this. And he shows me the watercolors the girl had made. Cute little things. A knife and a loaf of bread. The table and teapot. Everything running uphill. She was in love with me, he said. She was just like a child. I had to tell her when to brush her teeth and how to put her hat on. Here, look at the lollipops. I used to buy her a few lollipops every day. She liked them. Well, what did she do when her parents came to take her away? Did she put up a row? She cried a little, that's all. What could she do? She's underage. I had to promise never to see her again. Never to write her either. That's what I'm waiting to see now, whether she'll stay away or not. She was a virgin when she came here. The thing is, how long will she be able to go without a lay? She couldn't get enough of it when she was here. She almost wore me out. By this time, the one in the bed had come to and was rubbing her eyes. She looked pretty young to me, too. Not bad-looking, but dumb as hell. Wanted to know right away what we were talking about. She lives here in the hotel, said Carl. On the third floor. Do you want to go up to her room? I'll fix it up for you. I didn't know whether I wanted to or not, but when I saw Carl mushing it up with her again, I decided I did want to. I asked her first if she was too tired. Useless question. A whore is never too tired to open her legs. Some of them can fall asleep while you diddle them. Anyway, it was decided I would go down to her room. Like that, I wouldn't have to pay the patron for the night. In the morning, I rented a room overlooking the little park down below, where the sandwich board men always came to eat their lunch. At noon, I called for Carl to have breakfast with him. He and Van Norden had developed a new habit in my absence. They went to the Coupole for breakfast every day. Why the Coupole? I asked. Why the Coupole? Says Carl. Because the Coupole serves porridge at all hours, and porridge makes you shit. I see, said I. So it's just like it used to be again. The three of us walking back and forth to work. Petty dissensions, petty rivalries. Van Norden still bellyaching about his cunts and about washing the dirt out of his belly. Only now he's found a new diversion. He's found that it's less annoying to masturbate. I was amazed when he broke the news to me. I didn't think it was possible for a guy like that to find any pleasure in jerking himself off. I was still more amazed when he explained to me how he goes about it. He had invented a new stunt, so he put it. You take an apple, he says, and you bore out the core. Then you rub some cold cream on the inside so that it doesn't melt too fast. Try it sometime. It'll drive you crazy at first. Anyway, it's cheap and you don't have to waste much time. By the way, he says, switching the subject, that friend of yours, Fillmore, he's in the hospital. I think he's nuts. Anyway, that's what his girl told me. He took on a French girl, you know, while you were away. They used to fight like hell. She's a big, healthy bitch, wild-like. I wouldn't mind giving her a tumble, but I'm afraid she'd claw the eyes out of me. He was always going around with his face and hands scratched up. She looks bunged up, too, once in a while. Or she used to. You know how these French cunts are. When they love, they lose their minds. Evidently, things had happened while I was away. I was sorry to hear about Fillmore. He had been damned good to me. When I left Van Norden, I jumped a bus and went straight to the hospital. They hadn't decided yet whether he was completely off his base or not, I suppose, for I found him upstairs in a private room, enjoying all the liberties of the regular patients. He had just come from the bath when I arrived. When he caught sight of me, he burst into tears. It's all over, he said immediately. They say I'm crazy, and I may have syphilis too. They say I have delusions of grandeur. He fell over the bed and wept quietly. After he had wept a while, he lifted his head up and smiled, just like a bird coming out of a snooze. Why do they put me in such an expensive room? He said. Why don't they put me in the ward or in the bug house? I can't afford to pay for this. I'm down to my last $500. That's why they're keeping you here, I said. They'll transfer you quickly enough when your money runs out. Don't worry. My words must have impressed him, for I had no sooner finished than he handed me his watch and chain, his wallet, his fraternity pin, etc. Hold on to them, he said. These bastards will rob me of everything I've got. And then suddenly, he began to laugh, One of those weird, mirthless laughs which make you believe a guy's goofy whether he is or not. "I know you'll think I'm crazy," he said, "but I want to atone for what I did. I want to get married. You see, I didn't know I had the clap. I gave her the clap and then I knocked her up. I told the doctor I don't care what happens to me, but I want him to let me get married first. He keeps telling me to wait until I get better, but I know I'm never going to get better. This is the end." I couldn't help laughing myself hearing him talk that way. I couldn't understand what had come over him. Anyway, I had to promise him to see the girl and explain things to her. He wanted me to stick by her, comfort her, said he could trust me, etc. I said yes to everything in order to soothe him. He didn't seem exactly nuts to me, just caved in-like. Typical Anglo-Saxon crisis, an eruption of morals. I was rather curious to see the girl, to get the lowdown on the whole thing. The next day, I looked her up. She was living in the Latin Quarter. As soon as she realized who I was, she became exceedingly cordial. Jeanette, she called herself. Rather big, raw-boned, healthy peasant type, with a front tooth half eaten away, full of vitality and a kind of crazy fire in her eyes. The first thing she did was to weep. Then, seeing that I was an old friend of her, Jojo, that's how she called him, she ran downstairs and brought back a couple of bottles of white wine. I was to stay and have dinner with her. She insisted on it. As she drank, she became by turns gay and maudlin. I didn't have to ask her any questions. She went on like a self-winding machine. The thing that worried her principally was, would he get his job back when he was released from the hospital? She said her parents were well off, but they were displeased with her. They didn't approve of her wild ways. They didn't approve of him particularly. He had no manners, and he was an American. She begged me to assure her that he would get his job back, which I did without hesitation. And then she begged me to know if she could believe what he said, that he was going to marry her, because now, with a child under her belt and a dose of clap besides, she was in no position to strike a match, with a Frenchman anyway. That was clear, wasn't it? Of course, I assured her. It was all clear as hell to me, except how in Christ's name Fillmore had ever fallen for her. However, one thing at a time, it was my duty now to comfort her, and so I just filled her up with a lot of baloney, told her everything would turn out all right, and that I would stand godfather to the child, etc. Then, suddenly, it struck me as strange that she should have the child at all, especially as it was likely to be born blind. I told her that as tactfully as I could. "It doesn't make any difference," she said. "I want a child by him." "Even if it's blind?" I asked.
"Mon Dieu, ne dites pas ça," she groaned. "Ne dites pas ça."
Just the same, I felt it was my duty to say it. She got hysterical and began to weep like a walrus, poured out more wine. In a few moments, she was laughing boisterously. She was laughing to think how they used to fight when they got in bed.
"He liked me to fight with him," she said. "He was a brute."
As we sat down to eat, a friend of hers walked in, a little tart who lived at the end of the hall. Jeanette immediately sent me down to get some more wine. When I came back, they had evidently had a good talk. Her friend, Yvette, worked in the police department. A sort of stool pigeon, as far as I could gather. At least, that was what she was trying to make me believe. It was fairly obvious that she was just a little whore. But she had an obsession about the police and their doings. Throughout the meal, they were urging me to accompany them to a bal musette. They wanted to have a gay time. It was so lonely for Jeanette with Jojo in the hospital. I told them I had to work, but that on my night off, I'd come back and take them out. I made it clear, too, that I had no dough to spend on them. Jeanette, who was really thunderstruck to hear this, pretended that that didn't matter in the least. In fact, just to show what a good sport she was, she insisted on driving me to work in a cab. She was doing it because I was a friend of Jojo's, and therefore I was a friend of hers. And also, thought I to myself, if anything goes wrong with your Jojo, you'll come to me on the double quick. Then you'll see what a friend I can be. I was as nice as pie to her. In fact, when we got out of the cab in front of the office, I permitted them to persuade me into having a final perno together. Yvette wanted to know if she couldn't call for me after work. She had a lot of things to tell me in confidence, she said. But I managed to refuse without hurting her feelings. Unfortunately, I did unbend sufficiently to give her my address. Unfortunately, I say. As a matter of fact, I'm rather glad of it when I think back on it. Because the very next day, things began to happen. The very next day, before I had even gotten out of bed, the two of them called on me. Jojo had been removed from the hospital. They had incarcerated him in a little chateau in the country, just a few miles out of Paris. The chateau, they called it. A polite way of saying the bug house. They wanted me to get dressed immediately and go with them. They were in a panic. Perhaps I might have gone alone, but I just couldn't make up my mind to go with these two. I asked them to wait for me downstairs while I got dressed, thinking that it would give me time to invent some excuse for not going. But they wouldn't leave the room. They sat there and watched me wash and dress, just as if it were an everyday affair. In the midst of it, Carl popped in. I gave him the situation briefly in English, and then we hatched up an excuse that I had some important work to do. However, to smooth things over, we got some wine in, and we began to amuse them by showing them a book of dirty drawings. Yvette had already lost all desire to go to the chateau. She and Carl were getting along famously. When it came time to go, Carl decided to accompany them to the chateau. He thought it would be funny to see Fillmore walking around with a lot of nuts. He wanted to see what it was like in the nut house. So off they went, somewhat pickled, and in the best of humor. All the time that Fillmore was at the chateau, I never once went to see him. It wasn't necessary, because Jeanette visited him regularly and gave me all the news. They had hopes of bringing him around in a few months, so she said. They thought it was alcoholic poisoning, nothing more. Of course, he had a dose, but that wasn't difficult to remedy. So far as they could see, he didn't have syphilis. That was something. So, to begin with, they used the stomach pump on him. They cleaned his system out thoroughly. He was so weak for a while that he couldn't get out of bed. He was depressed, too. He said he didn't want to be cured. He wanted to die. And he kept repeating this nonsense so insistently that finally they grew alarmed. I suppose it wouldn't have been a very good recommendation if he had committed suicide. Anyway, they began to give him mental treatment. And in between times, they pulled out his teeth, more and more of them, until he didn't have a tooth left in his head. He was supposed to feel fine after that, yet, strangely, he didn't. He became more despondent than ever. And then his hair began to fall out. Finally, he developed a paranoid streak, began to accuse them of all sorts of things, demanded to know by what right he was being detained, what he had done to warrant being locked up, etc. After a terrible fit of despondency, he would suddenly become energetic and threaten to blow up the place if they didn't release him. And to make it worse, as far as Jeanette was concerned, he had gotten all over his notion of marrying her. He told her, straight up and down, that he had no intention of marrying her, and that if she was crazy enough to go and have a child, then she could support it herself. The doctors interpreted all this as a good sign. They said he was coming round. Jeanette, of course, thought he was crazier than ever, but she was praying for him to be released so she could take him to the country where it would be quiet and peaceful and where he would come to his right senses. Meanwhile, her parents had come to Paris on a visit and had even gone so far as to visit the future son-in-law at the chateau. In their canny way, they had probably figured it out that it would be better for their daughter to have a crazy husband than no husband at all. The father thought he could find something for Fillmore to do on the farm. He said that Fillmore wasn't such a bad chap at all. When he learned from Jeanette that Fillmore's parents had money, he became even more indulgent, more understanding. The thing was working itself out nicely all around. Jeanette returned to the provinces for a while with her parents. Yvette was coming regularly to the hotel to see Carl. She thought he was the editor of the paper. And little by little, she became more confidential. When she got good and tight one day, she informed us that Jeanette had never been anything but a whore, that Jeanette was a bloodsucker, that Jeanette never had been pregnant and was not pregnant now.